Lincoln, Disc 23.
Lincoln, who had a good idea of what went on in the caucus, was in anguish because of this new assault, coming so close after the devastating news from Fredericksburg. When he met Browning in the afternoon of December 18th, he asked, "What do these men want?" And he answered himself, "They wish to get rid of me, and I'm sometimes half disposed to gratify them." "We're now on the brink of destruction," he told Browning. "It appears to me the Almighty is against us, and I can hardly see a ray of hope." But when the committee representing the Senate caucus called at the White House at 7 o'clock that evening, he had regained his composure, and he greeted his visitors with what Fessenden called his usual urbanity. Patiently he listened as Collamer, the chairman of the committee, read resolutions that the senators had agreed on, which, in very general terms and without mentioning any names, called for changes in the composition of the cabinet, so that its members would agree with the president in political principles and general policy, and urged that no important military command should go to anyone who was not a cordial believer and supporter of the same principles. Wade then bluntly censured Lincoln for entrusting the conduct of the war to men who had no sympathy with it or the cause, and blamed Republican defeats in the recent elections on the fact that the president had placed the direction of our military affairs in the hands of bitter and malignant Democrats. After professing confidence in the integrity and patriotism of the president, Fessenden alleged that the cabinet were not consulted as a council. In fact, that many important measures were decided upon not only without consultation, but without the knowledge of its members. Seward, he claimed, exerted an injurious influence upon the conduct of the war. Branching out in his indictment, he went on to say that the commanders of the armies were largely pro-slavery men and sympathized strongly with the Southern feeling. And some of them, like McClellan, had used their position to blame the administration for failing to support them and their men. At this point, Lincoln interrupted. From his long experience in the courtroom, he knew the value of a well-timed digression as a way of defusing hostility. If the occasion hadn't been so serious, he might have told the senators an anecdote. Instead, producing a large bundle of papers, he spent nearly half an hour in reading aloud his letters to McClellan, showing that the government had consistently sustained him to the best of its powers. By the time the senators got back to their main subject, their tempers had cooled, and nobody got very excited about Sumner's charge that Seward had written offensive diplomatic dispatches which the president could not have seen or assented to. After 3 hours, the meeting broke up, without taking any action. By the end of the session, the president was, as Fessenden thought, apparently in cheerful spirits, and he promised to give careful consideration to the resolutions submitted by the committee. As they left the White House, radical Republicans were exultant at the prospect of getting rid of the whole cabinet, and Chandler rejoiced with "our best and truest men" that they were going to oust Seward, the millstone around the administration. The president had other plans. The next morning, at a cabinet meeting where all members except Seward were present, he reported on the resignation of the Secretary of State and on his visit from the committee representing the Republican caucus. He observed that they considered Seward the real cause of our failures. While they believed in the president's honesty, he said in his quaint language. They seemed to think that when he had in him any good purposes, Mr. Seward contrived to suck them out of him unperceived. He then asked the cabinet members to meet with him again, to have a free talk that evening at 7:30. The committee was invited for the same hour, and as senators and cabinet members met in the anteroom, they exchanged looks of wild surmise. The president began the meeting with a long statement, commenting with some mild severity on the resolutions presented by the senators the previous evening, admitting that he had not been very regular in consulting the cabinet as a whole, but arguing that most questions of importance had received a reasonable consideration, and that he was not aware of any divisions or want of unity. He then called on the members of the cabinet to state whether there had been any want of unity or of sufficient consultation. Most of the cabinet members unhesitatingly agreed that they had indeed been consulted on important matters. But Chase was in a very embarrassing position. If he now repeated his frequent complaints to the senators, his disloyalty to the president would be apparent. If he supported Lincoln's statement, it would be evident that he'd deceived the senators. Chase tried to get out of the trap by blustering that he should not have come here had he known that he was to be arraigned before a committee of the Senate. But finding no escape, he swallowed both truth and consistency and averred that questions of importance had generally been considered by the cabinet, though perhaps not so fully as might have been desired, and that there was no want of unity in the cabinet. The meeting went on for some time after that, as senators repeated all the familiar charges against Seward, but it was evident that Chase's forced admission had undercut the case against the Secretary of State. At 1 o'clock, when the senators and the cabinet officers left the White House, no conclusion had been reached, but there was a general feeling that there'd be no changes in the cabinet. Chase began to realize that his position was untenable and wrote out his resignation as Secretary of the Treasury. The next morning, when Lincoln summoned him to the White House, he brought the letter with him. He, along with Stanton and Welles, was already in the executive office when the president arrived. Turning at once to the Treasury Secretary, Lincoln said, "I sent for you, for this matter's giving me great trouble." Chase stammered that he, too, had been painfully affected by the meeting the previous night, and that he'd prepared his resignation. "Where is it?" asked Lincoln quickly. "I brought it with me," said Chase, taking a paper from his pocket. "I wrote it this morning." "Let me have it," said Lincoln, his long arm and fingers reaching out for the document, which Chase was apparently reluctant to release. Evidently, the secretary intended to say more, but Lincoln took the letter and opened it. "This cuts the Gordian knot," he said with a triumphant laugh. "I can dispose of this subject now." Then Stanton offered his resignation, but Lincoln brushed him aside. "You may go to your department," he told the Secretary of War. "I don't want yours." Then he ended the interview abruptly. "I'll detain neither of you longer." Having both Seward's resignation and Chase's in his hand, the president declined to accept either and insisted that both men remain in his cabinet. They balanced each other, he told Senator Ira Harris of New York. Remembering how, as a boy in Indiana, he'd worked out a way to carry pumpkins while he was on horseback, he told the senator, "I can ride on now, I've got a pumpkin in each end of my bag. By the end of the week, the cabinet crisis was over. In one sense, not much had been solved. Yet there were lessons from the crisis. Radicals learned that no matter how carefully they planned and intrigued, they lacked the power to take control of the government from the president. Lincoln told Browning firmly that he was master, and they should not do that. Chase's reputation had suffered a serious blow. When the crisis was over, senators asked Collamer how Chase, after alleging that the president had no system and failed to consult his advisers, could have told the group that the cabinet was harmonious. The blunt Vermont senator replied, "He lied." Fessenden accurately assessed the results. "He'll never be forgiven by many for deliberately sacrificing his friends to the fear of offending his and their enemies." Seward's place was secure. And to some, like Nicolay, it seemed that the secretary had achieved a triumph over those who attempted to drive him out, in this renewed assurance of the president's confidence and esteem. But reflection suggested that Seward now, more than ever, owed his place to the goodwill of the president. And in the months ahead, the secretary became more discreet in his utterances and meddled less in the affairs of other departments. Lincoln, too, learned from the experience. He now realized that he'd not been either very businesslike or even courteous about consulting his cabinet colleagues. For a time, he meticulously invited their opinions on controversial issues. For instance, at the very end of the year, he requested all of them to submit to him in writing their opinions as to whether he should veto or approve the bill that carved the new state of West Virginia out of the territory of Virginia. At a cabinet meeting on December 30th, he made a point of distributing copies of his draft of the Edict of Emancipation to be issued on January 1st. Asking each member to offer suggestions. Ignoring most of the substantive changes that cabinet members proposed, he accepted several stylistic improvements, and he added to his final Emancipation Proclamation a concluding paragraph, embodying an idea Chase proposed at the instigation of Charles Sumner. And upon this act, sincerely believed to be an act of justice, warranted by the Constitution upon military necessity, I invoke the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God. But more than anything else, the crisis taught Lincoln his own strength. Looking back on his handling of the affair nearly a year later, he told John Hay, "I don't now see how it could have been done better. I'm sure it was right. If I'd yielded to that storm and dismissed Seward, the thing would all have slumped over one way, and we should have been left with a scanty handful of supporters. When Chase sent in his resignation, I saw that the game was in my own hands, and I put it through." Proud that he was able to keep together an administration dominated neither by radicals nor by conservatives, he confided his final assessment of the crisis to Leonard Swett. "I may not have made as great a president as some other men, but I believe I've kept these discordant elements together as well as anyone could." Chapter 15. What Will the Country Say? Throngs attended the White House reception on New Year's Day of 1863. First came the members of the diplomatic corps, in full court dress, who were presented to the president by the Secretary of State. Lincoln shook hands with everyone in a cordial but businesslike manner, which reminded some observers of a farmer sawing wood. Then he passed the guests along to Mrs. Lincoln, who wore a rich dress of velvet with lozenge trimming at the waist. It was black, since she was still in mourning for Willie. Members of the cabinet followed the diplomats, and then came officers of the Army and Navy. In their wake, what young Fanny Seward, daughter of the Secretary of State, called people generally, passed through the reception line. Not until after noon could Lincoln escape upstairs to his office, where Seward and his son Frederick, the Assistant Secretary of State, presently brought him the duly engrossed copy of the final proclamation of emancipation. Accepting Tennessee and portions of other southern states that were already under the control of Union armies, it declared that all slaves in the states, or portions of states still in rebellion, are and henceforward shall be free. For this act of justice, warranted by the Constitution upon military necessity, the President invoked the considerate judgment of mankind and the gracious favor of Almighty God. I never in my life felt more certain that I was doing right than I do in signing this paper, Lincoln remarked. But he added ruefully that his arm was so stiff and numb from so many handshakes that he wasn't sure he could control a pen. Now this signature is one that'll be closely examined, he said, and if they find my hand trembled, they'll say he had some compunctions. But anyway, it's going to be done. Then, grasping the pen firmly, he slowly and carefully wrote his name at the end of the proclamation. In the months ahead, he would frequently need to exhibit the same care and firmness, for his administration was beset from all sides. Union armies were defeated or immobilized. Union naval expeditions were spectacular failures. The border states were in turmoil, and Missouri was the scene of a guerrilla war. Foreign powers offered to mediate the conflict between the Union and the Confederacy. Discontent was on the rise in the North, and confidential sources told the President that secret pro-Confederate societies were plotting to overthrow the administration. Within the Republican Party, factional lines sharpened, and both conservatives and radicals agreed that Lincoln was a failure as president. Whatever self-assurance Lincoln had gained from the cabinet crisis of December 1862 was sorely tested during the first 6 months of 1863, for he found that the shrewdness, tact, and forbearance that had served him so well in face-to-face disagreements were not easily applied to large groups in conflict. In short, Lincoln still had much to learn about how to be president. The year began with little good news from the armies. To be sure, in eastern Tennessee, Rosecrans's army more than held its own against Bragg's in the protracted and costly Battle of Stones River, December 30th through January 2nd, and Lincoln praised the general's skill, endurance, and dauntless courage. But when the Confederates withdrew from the field, Union forces didn't follow. For the rest of the winter, Rosecrans remained immobile at Murfreesboro, ignoring the president's prompting to advance against Chattanooga. Like Buell, Rosecrans found the roads impassable, supplies too hard to collect, and his lines of communication with Nashville and Louisville too tenuous. when Lincoln gently pointed out that the Confederates faced similar difficulties, but still were able to do much damage with small raids, harassing and discouraging loyal residents, supplying themselves with provisions, clothing, horses, and the like, and proposed mounting counter-raids, Rosecrans ignored his letter, doubtless resenting civilian interference in military decisions. Instead of acting against the enemy, he brooded over perceived slights. He complained bitterly that he was outranked because Grant was issued a commission as major general that antedated his own. The president was finally obliged to tell him bluntly, "Truth to speak, I don't appreciate this matter of rank on paper as you officers do. The world won't forget that you fought the Battle of Stone River, and it'll never care a fig whether you rank General Grant on paper or he so ranks you." Still, Rosecrans wouldn't move. Farther west, the outlook for the Union forces was even bleaker. On January 1st, the federal garrison at Galveston, Texas, surrendered to attacking Confederates. In Louisiana, General Benjamin F. Butler proved so rapacious that the president had to replace him. And the new commander, N.P. Banks, had yet to demonstrate his ability. Most serious of all was Grant's failure to capture Vicksburg. After an unsuccessful attempt to proceed overland through central Mississippi, Grant entrusted the offensive to W.T. Sherman, who led his troops on December 29th in a disastrous assault on the Chickasaw Bluffs defending Vicksburg that was reminiscent on a smaller scale of Burnside's fiasco at Fredericksburg. Recognizing how vital Vicksburg was, the president watched these operations closely. But in the months after Sherman's defeat, he heard mostly complaints about Grant. "The general," reported Murat Halstead of the Cincinnati Commercial, "is a jackass in the original package. He's a poor, drunken imbecile. He's a poor, stick-sober, and he's most of the time more than half drunk, and much of the time idiotically drunk." Further controversy rose over Grant's ill-conceived order banning Jew peddlers from his lines. The president promptly revoked it, as it proscribed an entire religious class, some of whom are fighting in our ranks. Most troubling of all was the situation of the Army of the Potomac, demoralized after Vicksburg. Burnside gained some credibility from his manly acknowledgment that he alone, and not the president nor the War Department, was responsible for the defeat. Greatly pleased at this statement, because he was used to being blamed for his subordinates' failures, Lincoln told Burnside he was the first man he'd found who was willing to relieve him of a particle of responsibility. But the general had lost the confidence of his subordinate officers and his troops. Learning that Burnside was preparing another assault on the impregnable Confederate defenses at Fredericksburg, two of his major generals, William B. Franklin and William F. Smith, violated military protocol by writing directly to the president, warning that the plan of campaign already commenced will not be successful. But when Halleck complained of the very disheartening inactivity of the Army of the Potomac, Burnside pushed ahead and began organizing a wide flanking movement to cross the Rappahannock River below Fredericksburg. At this point, discontent in the Army of the Potomac bubbled over. Many of the officers, convinced of Burnside's incompetence, were despondent almost to the point of mutiny. Anticipating another disaster, Generals John Newton and John Cochran, on December 30th, made a quick trip to Washington to alert the president of the danger. Though Lincoln distrusted the reports of all Lee's subordinates, because he was convinced their real purpose was to restore McClellan to command, he ordered a halt to Burnside's advance. "I have good reason for saying you must not make a general movement of the army without letting me know." On New Year's Day, before the public reception, Burnside came to the White House to explain and defend his plans. With an army of 120,000 men immediately confronting the enemy in Virginia, he thought it imperative to begin an advance, whether below or above Fredericksburg. But since not one of his division commanders supported his plan, he was willing to give it up, and with it, the command of the Army of the Potomac, and even his commission in the United States Army. In announcing that he would most cheerfully give place to any other officer, Burnside suggested that Lincoln ought to look not just at the ability of the commanding general, but at the honesty and loyalty of both Secretary of War Stanton and General-in-Chief Halleck. He warned that they hadn't given the president the positive and unswerving support in his public policy, or assumed their full share of the responsibility for that policy. Lincoln was in a quandary. Not knowing what else to do, he asked Halleck's opinion of Burnside's planned operation. The general declined to give one, making it clear, as he had on a previous occasion, that a general in command of an army in the field is the best judge of existing conditions. Impatiently, the president then directed Halleck to go to Burnside's headquarters, examine the ground, talk with the officers, and after forming his own opinion, tell Burnside either that he approved or disapproved of his planned advance. "If in such a difficulty as this you don't help, you fail me precisely in the point for which I sought your assistance," he wrote sharply. "Your military skill is useless to me if you won't do this." Halleck's response was to offer his resignation as General-in-Chief, on the ground that a very important difference of opinion in regard to my relations toward generals commanding armies in the field made it impossible to perform the duties of his office satisfactorily at the same time to the president and to myself. Lincoln felt he had no alternative but to rescind his order, endorsing it withdrawn because considered harsh by General Halleck. Heading an administration which he'd barely saved from collapse, after the two principal members had offered their resignations and others had been prepared to follow, and facing the likelihood of a change of command in the almost mutinous Army of the Potomac, the president could not permit further evidence of dissension among his advisers. But it was not a decision that he made readily, and in the future he spoke of Halleck as little more than a first-rate clerk. It was harder to know what to do with Burnside. Lincoln was always reluctant to dismiss a faithful subordinate, however unsuccessful. Perhaps the president remembered that at times he himself had seemed to most people a failure. He genuinely liked Burnside's modesty and loyalty. While recognizing the general's limitations, he admired his fighting spirit, and he respected the consummate skill and success with which he crossed and recrossed the river in face of the enemy. He tended to distrust the generals critical of Burnside, suspecting they were McClellan partisans. Anyway, there was no obvious successor to Burnside, and Lincoln wrote him candidly, "I don't yet see how I could profit by changing the command of the Army of the Potomac." The general was given one more chance. With Halleck's blessing, he planned to cross the Rappahannock west of Fredericksburg, hoping to flank Lee's army. Lincoln approved the advance, but instructed the general, "Be cautious, and do not understand that the government or country is driving you." On January 19th, the Army of the Potomac lumbered out of camp on a mission that most of Burnside's division commanders felt was doomed to failure. The weather reinforced their objections. As heavy rain turned to sleet, the army bogged down. And after 3 days, Burnside called off what reporters scornfully called the Mud March. Back in camp, Burnside boiled over. Blaming the failure on the disloyalty of his subordinates, he drafted an order dismissing 4 of his major generals from the army and relieving 4 other generals from their commands. Taking the order to Washington, he told Lincoln he could not continue in command unless the order was approved. "I think you're right," Lincoln said, but he reserved a decision until he could talk with Stanton and Halleck. The next morning, when Burnside returned to the White House, Lincoln told him he was to be replaced as commander of the Army of the Potomac. The president had difficulty in choosing a successor. Despite considerable public pressure, he gave no thought to restoring McClellan to command. He could have brought in either Rosecrans or Grant, though neither had yet been notably successful. But to impose a Western commander would have been insulting to the Army of the Potomac. Of Burnside's subordinates, E.V. Sumner was too old, Franklin and Smith were thought to be McClellan partisans, and others had yet to prove they could command a huge army. Rather uncertainly, Lincoln turned to Joseph Hooker. The general had some decided negatives. He was known to be a hard drinker. He'd been outspoken almost to the point of insubordination in his criticisms of Burnside's incompetence, and he let it be known that he viewed the president and the government at Washington as imbecile and played out. "Nothing would go right," he told a newspaper reporter, "until we had a dictator, and the sooner the better." But the handsome, florid-faced general had performed valiantly in nearly all the major engagements of the Peninsula campaign and at Antietam, where he'd been wounded, and his aggressive spirit earned him the sobriquet Fighting Joe. Lincoln decided to take a chance on him. Calling Hooker to the White House, he gave the general a carefully composed private letter, which commended his bravery, his military skill, and his confidence in himself. At the same time, he told Hooker, "There are some things in regard to which I'm not quite satisfied with you." He lamented Hooker's efforts to undermine confidence in Burnside and mentioned his recently saying that both the army and the government needed a dictator. "Of course," he continued, "it was not for this, but in spite of it, that I've given you the command. Only those generals who gain successes can set up dictators," he reminded the new commander. "What I now ask of you is military success, and I'll risk the dictatorship." Promising the full support of the government, he warned, "Beware of rashness." The appointment of Hooker, which was generally well received in the North, relieved some of the immediate pressure on the president. Everybody understood that the new commander would require some time to reorganize the Army of the Potomac and to raise the spirits of the demoralized soldiers. The president could, for the moment, turn his attention to other problems. Foreign relations didn't occupy a great deal of Lincoln's time. For the most part, he was content to allow the Secretary of State to manage diplomatic affairs, just as he permitted the other cabinet members to conduct the business of their departments with minimal interference. He trusted Seward, and he respected the Secretary's knowledge of diplomatic protocol. With most nations, the relations of the United States were entirely amicable, and there were few occasions that called for special exertions by either the Secretary of State or the President. No doubt Lincoln derived some amusement from his correspondence with the King of Siam, who, as a token of his goodwill and friendship for the American people in their present struggle, sent gifts of a photograph of himself, a sword and a scabbard, and a pair of elephant tusks, and offered to supply the government a stock of breeding elephants. "Our political jurisdiction," the President replied in words probably drafted by Seward, "does not reach a latitude so low as to favor the multiplication of the elephant. And steam on land as well as on water has been our best and most efficient agent of transportation in internal commerce." From time to time, the eccentric or unauthorized behavior of American diplomats caused minor ripples, as when Theodore Canisius, once Lincoln's partner in the Illinois Staatsanzeiger, and now American consul to Vienna, initiated, quite on his own, negotiations to offer a command in the Union armies to the great Italian general Garibaldi. Somewhat more serious was the game of musical chairs played with the American ministry to St. Petersburg. The post went first to Cassius M. Clay, the Kentucky abolitionist, as a reward for his strong support for Lincoln in the Chicago nominating convention of 1860. Despite several street brawls in which Clay demonstrated to startled Russian challengers the merits of the Bowie knife, the minister grew bored and sought a more active life in the Union Army. Lincoln replaced him with Simon Cameron, thinking St. Petersburg an excellent place to remove his first Secretary of War from the hands of his congressional investigators, hot on the scent of fraud and scandal. Cameron lasted only long enough to present his credentials to the Tsar, and then asked for a furlough so that he could come back to Pennsylvania and run for the Senate. Meanwhile, Clay proved noisy, importunate, and time-consuming with his constant advice to the President on how to conduct all aspects of the war. And Lincoln decided the Union cause would benefit by sending him back to Russia. The Tsar was graciously understanding, for his government throughout the war was staunchly pro-Union, and it repeatedly discouraged all suggestions of European intervention in the American conflict. Much more sensitive were relations with Great Britain and France, the two powers with major interests at stake in the American conflict. In neither was the government particularly favorable to the Union cause, and in both, the upper levels of society looked with scorn combined with fear at the democracy of the North and fancied a kinship to the slaveholding oligarchy of the South. The Union blockade, which cut off the export of Southern cotton, produced real suffering in the textile manufacturing regions of both Britain and France. Shipbuilders in France, and especially in Britain, saw the possibility of huge profits in outfitting vessels for the Confederate Navy. With so much at stake, the two great powers had early moved to issue proclamations of neutrality, which recognized the Confederacy as a belligerent, though not as an independent nation. These had doubtless been proper, even necessary, under international law, but the actions had struck the Lincoln government as precipitate. British willingness to go to the brink of war over the Trent Affair had offered further evidence that the American Civil War could be easily transformed into an international conflict. And the decision of the Emperor Napoleon III to send French troops to Mexico in order to bolster the shaky regime of his puppet king, Maximilian, was a direct challenge to the Monroe Doctrine and to the Union government. Holding firmly to his axiom, one war at a time, Lincoln allowed Seward to manage the day-to-day relations with the two great powers, but when there was a crisis, used his personal authority to preserve peace. For instance, early in 1863, when Union blockaders captured the Peterhof, a British-owned merchant ship carrying goods to Matamoros, Mexico, just across the Rio Grande from Brownsville, Texas, the British protested this violation of international law, while Secretary Welles defended the Navy, claiming the Peterhof was carrying contraband intended for the Confederacy. The mails aboard the Peterhof posed a specially touchy issue, because they might prove the vessel was really a blockade runner. The British, whose position was strongly backed by Seward, insisted that under international law, mails were inviolate, while Welles, whose views were endorsed by Sumner of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, argued that only the courts could decide whether they'd been lawfully seized. This controversy, which was in reality a minor affair, though it had the potential for becoming an explosive issue, occupied much of the time of the Secretary of State and the Secretary of the Navy until the middle of May, and Lincoln gave respectful hearing to both sides. In the end, the President sided with Seward and released the mails, reminding his cabinet members that we were in no condition to plunge into a foreign war on a subject of so little importance in comparison with the terrible consequences which must follow our act. Lincoln demonstrated the same caution in dealing with the larger issues of international relations. It was perhaps well that neither he nor Seward realized how close Great Britain and France came to intervening in the American conflict in the summer and fall of 1862, when a long succession of Confederate victories seemed to prove W.E. Gladstone's assertion that Jefferson Davis had made a nation of the Confederacy. Economic hardship, disruptions in the patterns of trade, and unwillingness to see a debilitating conflict further protracted moved Napoleon to suggest joint intervention to the British government. And both Lord Palmerston, the Prime Minister, and Earl Russell, the Foreign Secretary, looked favorably on the French plan. Only after an angry debate in the British cabinet, in which defenders of the Union were strengthened by the news of McClellan's success at Antietam and of Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation, was intervention rejected. Washington knew of these ominous developments only through rumor, and Lincoln was not, of course, obliged to take any official notice of them. But in early 1863, he couldn't ignore another scheme for foreign intervention in the war. Horace Greeley, the unpredictable editor of the New York Tribune, concluding that the war was hopeless, announced in his influential editorials that the North was ready to restore the Union as it was. That was tantamount to saying that the Emancipation Proclamation, which the editor had so vigorously urged on the president, should be dropped, and that mediation by England, France, or even Switzerland, if offered in a conciliatory spirit, would be welcomed. Greeley had come under the influence of an unstable mining speculator, William Cornell Colorado Jewett, just back from France with a mediation proposal from Napoleon III, and, flushed with enthusiasm, the editor dashed off to Washington to enlist the French minister, Henri Mercier, in his cause. He found the president noncommittal, and Charles Sumner, the chairman of the Senate Committee on Foreign Relations, said that the Union armies needed another chance for victory. But Greeley wasn't discouraged, and he told his fellow editor, Henry J. Raymond of the New York Times, that he intended to bring the war to a close by mediation. When Raymond asked what the president had to say about his scheme, he replied, "You'll see that I'll drive Lincoln into it." Greeley's attempt at peacemaking was so heavy-handed that Seward threatened to prosecute him under the Logan Act, which prohibited American citizens from negotiating with foreign representatives. Lincoln joked that the editor had probably done more to aid in the successful prosecution of the war than he could have done in any other way, because his over-earnest advocacy of peace had, on the principles of antagonism, made the opposition urge on the war. Certainly, Greeley's activities did much to blunt the impact of the formal proposal made by Napoleon's government, suggesting that the Union and the Confederacy appoint delegates to meet at some neutral place to explore the possibilities of reunion or permanent division of the United States. With Lincoln's entire approval, Seward promptly rejected the proposal. Virtually all American newspapers commended the government's course, and the often critical New York Herald praised not merely the masterly diplomacy of our sagacious Secretary of State, but also Lincoln's sagacity, consistency, and steadiness of purpose in sustaining him. The mediation crisis alerted the president to the importance of influencing public opinion abroad in favor of the Union cause. Charles Francis Adams, the American minister to the Court of St. James's, and William L. Dayton, the minister to France, were both doing excellent work, but their scope was necessarily restricted by their official positions and duties. To reach a wider public in Great Britain and France, Lincoln's administration encouraged informal missions by American businessmen, like the shipping magnate John Murray Forbes and the railroad tycoon William H. Aspinwall, by clergymen like Catholic Archbishop John J. Hughes and Episcopal Bishop Charles P. McIlvaine, and by worldly-wise politicians like Thurlow Weed, who could explain and defend their government's actions. At the same time, Lincoln himself began a campaign to win popular support in Great Britain, where, with some hidden subvention from American funds, numerous public meetings were held to voice support for the Union cause, and especially for the emancipation of the slaves. With the help of Charles Sumner, the American who had perhaps the widest circle of acquaintances abroad, the president drafted shrewdly crafted messages to the working men of Manchester and London, voicing sympathy for their suffering in unemployment and skillfully blaming the cotton shortage not on the Union blockade of the South, but on the actions of our disloyal citizens. Lavishly he praised the ardent unionism of British working men, whose self-interest would have dictated support of the Confederacy. They offered, the president said, an instance of sublime Christian heroism which hasn't been surpassed in any age or in any country. In these messages to British working men, Lincoln oversimplified the complex American struggle, ignoring the fact that his government had for nearly 2 years firmly refused to make emancipation a Union war aim. He now claimed that the conflict was a test whether a government established on the principles of human freedom can be maintained against an effort to build one upon the exclusive foundation of human bondage. Once the American Civil War was so understood, he was convinced that there could be no doubt where British sympathies would lie. In the hope of putting the issue even more forcefully, he drafted a statement that he asked Sumner to present to British friends of the Union, pointing out that the fundamental objective of the rebellion was to maintain, enlarge, and perpetuate human slavery, and resolving that no such embryo state, such as the Confederacy, should ever be recognized by or admitted into the family of Christian and civilized nations. The effectiveness of the president's personal propaganda warfare couldn't be measured, for it wasn't so much public statements or popular rallies as the internal dynamics of British and French politics, plus fears of ultimate American reprisal, that determined a course of neutrality for the two major European powers. But for Lincoln, the opportunity to use the White House as a pulpit, to speak out over the dissonant voices of foreign leaders to the common people, daringly broadened the powers of the presidency. It was a practice he could, in the future, use to good effect at home. Greeley wasn't alone in advocating mediation by foreign powers. Heartened by their successes in the recent fall elections, Democrats made mediation by the French emperor part of the broad assault they launched upon the Lincoln administration. In December, on the first day of the session, Representative S.S. Sunset Cox of Ohio began the attack with a resolution demanding the immediate release of all political prisoners and charging that arbitrary arrests were unwarranted by the Constitution and laws of the United States and a usurpation of power never given up by the people to their rulers. In January, as the military situation deteriorated, Senator Willard Salisbury of Delaware, whose dark, scowling face made him look like a chained mastiff, lamented that the president treated the abridgment of civil liberties with jocular and criminal indifference, and he warned that the recently issued final Emancipation Proclamation would light their author to dishonor through all future generations. More important was the full-scale address Representative Clement L. Vallandigham made on January 14th in the House of Representatives. Handsome, plausible, and articulate, the Ohio congressman denounced Lincoln's effort to restore the Union by war as an utter, disastrous, and most bloody failure, claiming that the president, by repeated and persistent arbitrary arrests, the suspension of habeas corpus, the violation of freedom of the mails, of the private house, of the press, and of speech, and all the other multiplied wrongs and outrages upon public liberty and private right, had converted the United States into one of the worst despotisms on earth. Vallandigham sought the intervention of a friendly foreign power to bring about an informal, practical recognition of the Confederacy. Vallandigham, did not speak for the entire Democratic Party. War Democrats, who consistently supported Lincoln's efforts to subdue the Confederacy, sustained his administration in all measures they considered constitutional. But many other Democrats throughout the country, weary of the bloodshed, were ready to end the war through negotiation and compromise. At a mass meeting in New York City, for instance, the former mayor, the unsavory and duplicitous Fernando Wood, spoke for these peace Democrats when he urged the president to cease hostilities, call a conference with the Confederates, and restore the Union without further loss of blood. Extreme opponents of the administration favored peace at any price. Some favored subverting the Lincoln administration, and a few of these were in contact with Southern authorities. Republicans called them copperheads, probably after the poisonous snake that attacks without notice. Discontent was strongest and most dangerous in the Middle West. When the war broke out, Westerners had quickly rallied to the colors, and these recruits made up the powerful Union armies that operated in the Mississippi Valley. They'd suffered uncounted losses during the first 2 years of the war, and many were growing angry and disillusioned. After volunteering almost stopped during the winter of 1862-63, the Lincoln administration put its weight behind a new conscription act signed by the president on March 3rd. It promised further hardship for Western farms and families. Western dissatisfaction was the greater because that region had only imperfectly shared in the general prosperity that the war brought to the North. As long as the Confederacy controlled the Mississippi River, the main Western trade outlet was blocked, and Westerners were forced to pay prohibitively high freight rates to send their produce east by canal and rail. At the same time, Republican tariff legislation protected Northeastern manufacturers at the expense of Western consumers. But the greatest cause of disaffection in the West was Lincoln's emancipation policy. Few Westerners were abolitionists. Those who joined the Republican Party in the 1850s were, like Lincoln himself, more concerned with the expansion of slavery into the national territories than with its eradication. A considerable majority of Westerners, especially those in the lower parts of Ohio, Indiana, and Illinois, where ties of family and commerce to the South were strong, were Democrats of the Stephen A. Douglas stripe, devoted to the preservation of the Union, but indifferent to the future of slavery. For these, the Emancipation Proclamation changed the character of the war. Democratic leaders in the Western states now told their followers, "We told you so. The war is solely an abolition war. We're for putting down rebellion, but not for making it an anti-slavery crusade." Fear that emancipation would lead to a heavy immigration of freedmen from the South strengthened Western hostility toward the administration. "Ohio," it was predicted, "will be overrun with Negroes. They'll compete with you and bring down your wages. You'll have to work with them, eat with them. Your wives and children must associate with theirs, and you and your families will be degraded to their level." This fear wasn't wholly irrational. Stanton, in September, had ordered the contrabands assembled at Carroll, Illinois, sent north to replace farm laborers who'd joined the army. Anxiety on this subject was pervasive enough that Lincoln felt obliged to devote several pages of his December 1862 message to Congress to refuting this largely imaginary, if not sometimes malicious, objection to emancipation. Cleverly, he tried to turn it into an argument for the colonization of the freedmen, in congenial climes and with people of their own blood and race. But Westerners weren't convinced, and many believed that the effect of the president's emancipation policy would be to establish Negro equality. In the West, discontent manifested itself in sporadic outbreaks of violence. In several counties, there was resistance to the arrest of deserters from the Union armies. On occasion, Union men or soldiers at home on furlough were murdered. There were demonstrations and armed parades against continuing the war. Ugly racism was often evident in these outbreaks. In a Detroit race riot, many blacks were beaten and some 35 houses were burned. Numerous mass meetings and county conventions announced that the Union can never be restored by force of arms, protested the conversion of the war into an abolition crusade, challenged the impending conscription legislation as unconstitutional, and called for a ceasefire. Many of these meetings favored summoning a national convention to be held at Louisville on the first Tuesday in April in order to obtain an armistice and cessation of hostilities. So strong was anti-war sentiment that the Times of London believed that Lincoln's Emancipation Proclamation had proved a solvent which has loosened the federal bond in the North itself, and predicted the imminent secession of the Western states from what remained of the Union. Many Western Unionists shared that foreboding, and they passed along their fears to the president. John A. McClernand, a sturdy Illinois Democrat, warned the president of the rising storm in the middle and northwestern states, and predicted not only a separation from the New England states, but reunion of the middle and northwestern states with the revolted states. Republicans were even more alarmed, finding treason everywhere, bold, defiant, and active with impunity. In Illinois, the Democratic majority in the state legislature insisted that the Union couldn't be restored unless Lincoln withdrew the Emancipation Proclamation and urged him to declare an armistice. They also tried to appoint delegates to the Louisville Peace Convention to block arbitrary arrests and to prohibit the immigration of blacks into the state. Republican Governor Richard Yates felt obliged to prorogue the legislature for the first time in history and to rule without legislative authorization. Similarly, in Indiana, the Democrats who controlled the legislature threatened to take over control of the state's military efforts. They were blocked only when the Republican members, bolting the chamber to prevent a quorum, brought about adjournment before any appropriations bills could be passed. For the next 2 years, Republican Governor Oliver P. Morton governed the state without legislative authorization. Both governors attributed Democratic obduracy to secret pro-Confederate organizations, especially the Knights of the Golden Circle, which were allegedly fomenting disloyalty throughout the West. Lincoln credited these reports of discontents and conspiracies. Governor Yates, whom he'd known for many years, had his entire confidence, but he wasn't quite so ready to believe Morton, who, he said, was at times the scaredest man I know of. When the governor urged him to meet him in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, to confer on the crisis, Lincoln refused. because the absence of both the President of the United States and the Governor of Indiana from their respective capitals would be misconstrued a thousand ways. Nevertheless, he read attentively Morton's long report, drafted by the reformer Robert Dale Owen, detailing the activities of secret peace societies in the West and revealing the Democratic plan to end the war, recognize the Confederacy, and organize a new nation with the New England states left out. All such news the President found exceedingly troubling. He never realized that most of the supposedly disloyal agitation in the West was less an expression of hostility to the Union or the war than to the Republican Party. Deeply worried, he confided to Charles Sumner that he now feared the fire in the rear, meaning the Democracy, especially at the Northwest, more than our military chances. Promptly, his administration moved to support the loyal Republican regimes in the West and to stamp out disaffection and discontent. In January, Yates informed him that it was imperative to have four well-armed regiments stationed in Illinois in order to keep an eye on the legislature and disperse it if necessary. And the President promptly endorsed the proposal. When Morton, who was trying to govern in the absence of the state legislature, ran out of money, Stanton was able to find $250,000 for him in the budget of the Union War Department. The administration employed the new conscription law not merely to raise troops, but to suppress dissent. Lincoln named Colonel Charles B. Fry Provost Marshal, and assistant provost marshals were assigned to each state, where they worked closely with the governors. Their primary duty was to enroll soldiers, but if they encountered opposition, as they did in many parts of the West, they promptly jailed the disaffected, invoking Lincoln's suspension of the writ of habeas corpus to deny them trial. Newspapers that attacked the government too vigorously or tried to discourage enlistments were suppressed, sometimes for a single issue, sometimes for a longer period. Lincoln had the bad judgment to put Ambrose E. Burnside in charge of his effort to keep the West loyal to the Union. Fresh from his defeat at Fredericksburg, Burnside, as commander of the Department of the Ohio, was determined that no carelessness or oversight on his part should lead to further disaster, and he energetically fought what he considered treason, expressed or implied. On April 13th, he issued General Order No. 38, announcing that anyone who committed acts for the benefit of the enemies of our country would be arrested and tried as a spy or traitor. The order specifically prohibited the habit of declaring sympathies for the enemy. Vallandigham, the leading peace Democrat in the West, resolved to test this order, which clearly violated the constitutional guarantee of freedom of speech. And on May 1st, he made a bitter, rousing address at Mount Vernon, Ohio, denouncing Burnside's order as a base usurpation of tyrannical power. He attacked the President as King Lincoln, who was waging war for the liberation of the blacks and the enslavement of the whites. 4 days later, Burnside had him arrested, and a military commission promptly found him guilty of declaring disloyal sentiments and opinions with the object and purpose of weakening the power of the government in its efforts to suppress an unlawful rebellion. The former congressman was sentenced to close confinement in a United States fortress for the duration of the war. Vallandigham's arrest and trial posed a dangerous problem for Lincoln. His instinctive judgment was to sustain the action of his subordinate in the field. Burnside had sent a copy of his Order No. 38 to Washington, and neither Halleck nor the president disapproved of it. After all, the general was acting under the authority of the president's own proclamation of September 24, 1862, suspending the writ of habeas corpus. That authority was further strengthened by a recent act of Congress which, depending on the legislator's interpretation, either granted the president authority to suspend the great writ or affirm that he already had the authority. Accordingly, on May 8th, Lincoln telegraphed Burnside his kind assurance of support in the Vallandigham arrest. On reflection, he came to view the arrest in another light. All the cabinet regretted the necessity of arresting Vallandigham, and some doubted that there really was a necessity. Gideon Welles judged bluntly it was an error on the part of Burnside. Within the administration, there was unhappiness that the ex-congressman had been tried before a military tribunal, even though the civil courts in Ohio were available. David Davis, now a justice of the Supreme Court, repeatedly hammered on the theme that military trials in these circumstances were unconstitutional and wrong, and he capitalized on the president's own known opposition to such military tribunals. As Halleck wrote Burnside, "In the loyal states like Ohio, it's best to interfere with the ordinary civil tribunals as little as possible." Others regretted that Vallandigham had been sentenced to imprisonment rather than to banishment to the Confederate lines. The dismay over Burnside's actions within the administration was nothing when compared to the furor of anger the arrest of Vallandigham roused in the country. The rabidly Democratic New York Atlas set the tone by declaring that the tyranny of military despotism exhibited in the arrest of Vallandigham demonstrated the weakness, folly, oppression, mismanagement, and general wickedness of the administration at Washington. At a huge rally in New York City, one speaker asserted that if Vallandigham's arrest went unrebuked, free speech dies, and with it our liberty, the Constitution, and our country. Another pointedly reminded the president that Vallandigham's speech was not nearly so strong as Lincoln's own denunciation of President Polk in the Mexican War. Still another shouted that the man who occupied the presidential chair at Washington was tenfold a greater traitor to the country than was any Southern rebel. Across the country, newspapers, many of unquestioned loyalty, assailed the arrest of Vallandigham and joined the New York Herald in fearing that it was only the first of a series of fatal steps which must terminate at last in bloody anarchy. Bowing to pressure, Lincoln, on May 19th, against the advice of General Burnside, commuted Vallandigham's sentence and ordered that the ex-congressman be exiled to the Confederacy. The Vallandigham affair had a chastening effect on Lincoln. On June 1st, when Burnside ordered the strongly anti-war Chicago Times suspended, the president immediately overruled him. Though the paper, edited by Wilbur F. Story, had strongly condemned the administration's emancipation policy as a monstrous usurpation, a criminal wrong, and an act of national suicide, and said the president was sacrificing soldiers' lives without cause, Lincoln said the irritation produced by suppressing the newspaper would do more harm than its publication. But the damage resulting from the Vallandigham case was too extensive to be erased. Ohio Democrats showed what they thought of the president by nominating Vallandigham for governor, though he was still in exile. More important, the episode had a profound effect on the war Democrats. Their most prominent spokesman, Governor Horatio Seymour of New York, denounced the arrest as an offense against our most sacred rights and warned that the administration was moving toward revolution and military despotism.
This ends Disc 23.